You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras, where we'll be talking National League East. The division that, again, continues to have a fairly reliable look. The Nationals are not running away, but they have definitely established themselves as the class of division. Proved their mettle in a tough Western road trip and came out of that with some wins and look like a team that is very well positioned for October. Braves fighting for a playoff spot, very much in the wild card hunt. Still some chances to play Washington and still a chance to maybe make that division race a little closer. And then after that, some teams with some very different reasons to watch. The Marlins had a little bit of a rough go here lately after getting right up into the mix for the wild card, but still a team that really wants its players to feel like they're playing in a postseason race and get some experience for a young club. The Phillies have actually come on pretty strong, and they look like they're a team that's not fading away, and that's impressive for a club that's had a rough year, had high expectations. They are not going away. They're still a tough out, and the Mets are getting a look at some young players and trying to build excitement for next year while still trying to avoid fifth place and trying to remain within shouting distance. We'll be talking ball with all five of MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. So about to get ready. Thanks for listening, everybody. Talking Washington Nationals with MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter, Bill Ladson. Bill, aside from the games on the field, it seems like the biggest news with the Nationals these days may be the progression of Ryan Zimmerman. What's your understanding of how he's coming along right now?
From what I understand through Matt Williams is that he's slowly getting better, and he's hoping that Zimmerman can come back by the end of September. I mean, that remains to be seen because, obviously, Zimmerman can't rush to get back. You know, he has a grade 3 hamstring, which means it's torn. There's a tear. So, you know, it remains to be seen if he's back by the end of September. If he is, I mean, he's going to be part of a great lineup because, to me, he's their best hitter.
They made a move essentially to cover for his absence in bringing in Asdrubal Cabrera. I don't want to put the cart ahead of the horse, but if Zimmerman comes back, what's the kind of sequence of events that goes on in the lineup? Does that make Cabrera a bench player, or how does that all kind of come together?
Yeah, he's going to be a bench player, basically, and Rendon's going to go back to second, and Zimmerman will be at third. So, you know, I'm sure that you know, Cabrera will be like a defensive replacement a lot of the time because, as you know, Zimmerman has a sore shoulder as well, which is going to be there forever. So that's how that's going to work out.
Now, we've seen guys, and you've seen this, I've seen this, guys can get healthy enough to be on a roster, but it's another matter getting to the point where you can really be an impactful big league player. What do you think are the chances that Zimmerman not only is sort of healthy enough to stand there, swing a bat, but really gets to a point where he can be a real factor either in the regular season or in the postseason this year?
Well, I think the last time he was on the DL, he got off to a slow start. I think what's going to have to happen, which I think will happen, is that he'll go to instructional league and before he comes back. And then I expect him to be in that starting lineup. To me, he's their best hitter. And you know what's amazing to me? Even though he's played so little, he still drove in 32 runs. I mean, I didn't realize that until I just looked at the stats, you know, a month ago. So, I mean, it's really amazing how great of a hitter he is, and that's why he's an impactful player.
How will they make it work? You mentioned instructional league. Is that the way they'll make it work, to, again, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but if he gets healthy enough to play baseball, would it likely be instructional league where he'd go to get into game shape? Because, again, that's another challenge. You can get healthy, but getting to Major League Baseball shape is another question.
Matthew, there's no question because I go back to 2007 when Willie Tovar started the postseason on the DL, and they sent him to instructional league to be ready for the next round. So I believe that that's the way they're going to go about it. I mean, that's really the only way to go about it for Zimmerman to get in game shape.
to get him back, and again, we are talking weeks away likely, but to get him back to a lineup that's got Jason Wirth having a really good year and Bryce Harper really coming on strong, it seems like really makes this a formidable heart of the lineup. It seems to me like Harper is well, not doesn't seem, the numbers bear it out, is really coming on. What are you seeing from him right now that maybe wasn't there a few weeks ago?
Well, obviously, the thumb is 100% now, and you don't see him wiggling the thumb. He's not having any problems whatsoever. I mean, the problem he was having was against left-handers, and he had a couple of homers against left-handed pitching in Seattle, so that was a great sign. And to see him hit the ball up the middle as often as he did in Seattle, that was another great sign. Now, he went hitless yesterday, but I think he is back simply because he's providing power, he's getting strength back in the thumb, and he's doing the job like he's been doing that we've known to seeing like in the past.
To go to the other side of things, I was looking at the numbers for this club and quietly filling what was really a huge need. It seems like Matt Thornton has been really good for this club. What did they see when they picked him up, and how has he kind of fit into what was a good bullpen really before he even arrived?
Well, what happened was Jerry Blevins was in a slump, and he couldn't get, at one point, lefties out or even righties out. So that's where Matt Thornton fits in. I mean, I think if Blevins had been pitching well, I don't think Thornton would have came in, but Thornton throws lightning. And the guy's like over 95 miles an hour when he throws. So as I look at Matt Thorne, I'm just shocked that the Yankees let him go. I mean, it's like, why they let him go? So that's still a mystery to me.
Well, and that was sort of what I wonder. I mean, because it didn't take a lot to get him. You know, that this was not a difficult acquisition. I mean, it really does kind of stand out that this guy who was having a pretty good year for the Yankees but has just been so good since the deal.
Yes, he has. And he's just been, he's just been unhittable, and it's because of that fastball he has, and it's going to be a great, great bullpen once it's all said and done.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that really is one of the big differences from last year is some of what they're getting from the bullpen, and one guy that really stands out in that regard is Drew Storen, who obviously a lot went on. He had a rough year last year, and he is the guy they thought he was this year. What's different for him in 2014 compared to 2013?
He's healthy, and he improved his mechanics. You know, if you remember, at one point his leg was way up there when he was throwing the ball, but not anymore. So mechanics had a lot to do with it, and he is healthy now too. And he realizes now, I think it's a mental thing as well, that he's no longer the closer. And I think he will never be the closer as long as he's a National. And it'll be great to see him perform in the postseason. To me, it's going to be different than what it was in 2012.
Yeah, I mean, there was this sort of, and it may have been lazy, and I guess that's what I ask, was this just sort of lazy inventing a narrative, or was there really, were there really some kind of lingering effects from what happened in the 2012 postseason? Is it a matter of him overcoming some of that stuff, or is it, again, like you say, really just a matter of getting healthy, getting the mechanics right?
It's a combination of things. It was mental and it was mechanics. But I want to say this to you, Matthew. Now, it's not like I spoke to Storen. No one really has. But I think Storen was furious that they brought in Soriano to become the closer. And I'm telling you, him and Clifford were not happy that that Soriano was brought in. Now, they all get along, but he wasn't happy because they thought this was punishment for what happened in the postseason.
So is this kind of a matter of maybe finally getting over that and kind of knowing this is how it is? And
yes, he is over. Yes, there's no question he's over it because look at the numbers. He's been really outstanding this year, so quietly outstanding. So that's why.
All right, well, Bill Adson, thanks for taking some time here on MLB.com Extras, joined by MLB.com's Braves beat reporter, Mark Bowman. Mark, about this time last year, maybe earlier last year, It seemed like there was a lot of talk that maybe Alex Wood's future was in the bullpen, that for whatever reason, his delivery or his repertoire or whatever, that, you know, maybe they'd get some starts out of him now, but in the long run, that probably wasn't where he would end up. After his latest, and not just one, but the latest of many really outstanding starts, safe to say we can put that notion to rest?
I think for now. You know, I think barring any type of injury, his future is as a starter. And I think the talk about starter versus reliever really was fueled during spring training leading into the 2013 season. That's the first time, you know, most people got a chance to see this odd delivery. And you're saying, well, you know, if you subject him to the innings of a starter, you're going to increase the chance of him getting hurt and, you know, this and that. Well, you know, if you really break down the mechanics, they're odd, just like Chris Sale, and that's the guy that he gets compared to from a mechanical standpoint most often. But, you know, when he gets to his the key points, you know, when his landing leg, his front leg lands, his arm's in the right place. And, you know, I think that the Braves did a lot of study with that and said, look, I don't think he's going to get hurt. And they took the risk, or, you know, whatever risk there was of using him as a starter, and they're benefiting from that because this guy does have a chance to be a legit number two and possibly an ace in the future.
Has he been better than expected just as far as the production?
I can't see how anyone could have expected him to be this good this soon. You know, just 2 years ago, he's leaving the University of Georgia. And he was a good pitcher in the SEC. I mean, he was effective. Here's a guy who, even if you go back to his first start at Georgia, it was on the road at UCLA. Here he is, a redshirt freshman coming off Tommy John surgery. Nobody really knows who he is, but the guy he's matching up with that night, Garrett Cole, everyone's talking about how he's going to be the number one pick a few months later, which he was, and Alex Wood beat him that night there. And that just kind of, he opened some eyes there and just continued to do so as he improved his mechanics, continued to be more consistent with his pitches. Like I said, I don't think anyone could have predicted him to be this good this soon, but Billy Bridges, the scout who kept an eye on him there in Athens and throughout the SEC trail, the day that they drafted him, he said they had something special. You know, they got him as a second rounder, and he said this is a first-round arm that has a chance to do some special things at the big league level.
He had a really interesting path this year with that mid-season trip to the pen to kind of keep his workload down. With the way that has worked out, is that maybe a model going forward as everybody tries to figure out how do you manage young starters, how do you keep them healthy, how do you keep them fresh? Is that method potentially a model for future Braves pitchers and maybe even other organizations?
Yeah, I think it's the debate with that would be, I mean, obviously you've got to find a way. If you're going into a season to limit innings, you're looking, you know, we'll just use his innings limit or the projection that they wanted, 170 to 180 innings. If you go into a season like that, you can start him off at the beginning of the season, put them in the rotation, and then take them out like they did with Alex in May for, it ended up being 6 or 7 weeks, and then bring them back. The argument against that would be, you know, not everyone's going to make that transition. Maybe it wasn't necessarily a real smooth transition for Alex either. I mean, he had a couple bumps in the road there right after he came back to the rotation. In other words, you go from starter to reliever and back to starter. That's not really all that easy. Is it better off? I don't know if anyone would ever go with the model of, okay, well, we're not going to even have him make his first start until May. You know, in other words, just take off April. There may be an argument for that instead of subjecting the arm to that the workload of a starter, then reliever, then starter. But at the same time, if you do that, you know, you're making assumptions. I mean, those are games that you know that he can impact early in the season. There would be two different schools of thought there. My thinking is, you better go ahead and start him in the rotation at the end of the season because you don't know how everyone else is going to fare. What if you had even more injuries this year and you didn't have a choice to even take him out of the rotation? You've got to win those games when you have a chance, and then make you get to a point where you do have to take him out of the rotation in September, like the Nationals did with Strasburg. But I think more teams are going to try to do what the Braves did, find a point, whether it's at the very beginning of the season, somewhere in the middle, to take these kids out, give them a little break, and then put them on back in line for that innings projection that you set at the beginning of the year.
How did they come up with that specific plan? Because, again, it is really unusual, as all these ways we've tried to go about this. This one is different, for sure.
Yeah, this was, I think in some ways, I don't know if they had a set date coming into this season when they were going to do it. And the reason I say that is you had Medlin and Beachy go down to spring training. That changed some things. Then you had Santana starting a little late. You had Gavin Floyd and Mike Myers starting at the beginning of May. And I think, if you would have asked them on April 1st, when is Alex Wood going to be shut down, they would not have said May 4th or May 5th. They may have had that in mind somewhere in that area. But, with so many different moving pieces at that point in time, so many different variables with Floyd and Meyer, especially still not knowing exactly when they would be back, they just had to kind of, go ahead and stay flexible. And the other part of that equation that Alex influence was once he exited in April, he had such a good April. He's going 7-8 innings every start. He was on pace to go 220, 230 innings leaving April. So he may have even accelerated the stopping point a little bit himself just with the success that he had that first month.
Now, as Wood has been on the rise here lately, and I don't want to make too much of it, but the Braves are in a place where every little bit matters and their margin is pretty fine. Julio Teheran has been a little less effective in the second half. Since the break, he's looking at an ERA in 3.5, which isn't bad, but again, isn't what they were looking for. I think maybe a little more concerning, last four starts, 11 strikeouts, 9 walks in 25 innings. Those are kind of disconcerting ratios, even as the ERA has been back down. What do you see from him these last several weeks?
Yeah, I see a guy who, at times he's the same dominant guy that we saw throughout much of the first half. But I'll go back to yesterday, and it was a hot, humid day. But I really think fatigue played a factor. He's got bases loaded. He's got a 1-2 count against Ben Revere, and the slider that he has buried, and dominated guys against, all year long, he hangs it, and Ben Revere sends it over Jason Hayward's head, and everything about that, you wouldn't have predicted happening. So I just see a guy who is showing some signs of fatigue, and I think if, unfortunately, last year and maybe even the year before, the Braves had some opportunities to take advantage of off days and give some of their young pitchers some rest down the stretch. That's not going to happen this year. They're in the heart of this pennant race. They certainly aren't going to skip anyone the rest of the way here. In other words, we got the Braves have an off day on Thursday. You're not going to see them come back and say, well, we're going to bring Teron back on 5 days rest. They're going to take advantage of any off day they have. The one thing I see is a guy whose slider has not been as crisp, especially later in the game. And he's, if you looked at it like yesterday, he allowed 3 hits through the first 6 innings. He was cruising. And, that 7th inning just kind of got away from him. And a little bit, he had the intentional walk to Cody Ashe, and then he walked Grady Sizemore to load the bases, and Sizemore was pinch hitting for Hamels. That's the one guy you got. He had 2 guys that he could have gotten out of there. You would have expected him to get out that inning clean earlier in this season by either retiring Sizemore or Revere, and he didn't get it done yesterday.
One last thing before I let you go, I was looking and. Evan Gattis, when he came off the DL, had this nice little burst, and it was very encouraging. But since those first few games, he has not been very good lately. He has not been hitting the way that this team saw him hit early in the year and really needs him to hit. Is he hindered at all? Do you think there's anything going on there physically? Is it just a slump? What, when you see Gattis, why do you think it is that, that he's not hitting like he was earlier in the year?
You know, I think the first thing you have to ask is, whenever anybody has a back injury, are you hindered? And I have asked, and he says he's fine, you know, and I have not seen the production. I am not surprised because, like I said, when you have a back injury, they seem to linger and weaken you in different ways throughout the rest of the year. The other thing, the other component that's weighing against Gattis is he's 6'4", 250 pounds, playing the catcher position on a regular basis. I just think he's worn down. And this goes back to, you know, would should they have pulled the trigger and tried to make a deal for him before the trade deadline? Maybe. In hindsight, it's easy to say, you know, if hindsight's 20/20, which it always is, it's that's easy to say right now. But I think this heightens, you know, the reason or highlights why you would trade Gattis during the offseason. Here's a guy who has tremendous power. You know, you have to question whether he's going to be durable enough to handle the catching position and provide that power to over the course of an entire season. And no, I think that if you send him, dangled him to an American League team and gave them the opportunity to use him as a DH frequently, put him behind the plate here and there, I think he's going to, you might get some value in return for him. So I do expect them to be sharp this offseason. The question is, you know, how much will these late season struggles influence what his value is, you know, during this offseason?
All right. Well, Mark Bowman, thanks for taking some time to chat.
Talking Miami Marlins with MLB.com's Marlins beat reporter, Joe Fusaro. Joe, it seems like the odds are getting a little longer here. The Marlins got real close to being right in the middle of this, and then things have kind of turned a little bit, some tough losses. Is there some sense that maybe things are kind of turning the wrong direction here?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, they, you know, there's a lot of scoreboard watching, and, you know, with sub-500 teams and you're losing games and series to them and having missed opportunities or lack of shutdown innings or lack of big hits kind of mounting, there's that realization. But I think this also is a team that's kind of been through everything, and in their eyes, they're just going to keep fighting and plugging away is where they're looking for the veterans. I mean, the realistic picture is win as many as you can, stay in as long as you can, try to, you know, hope for one more, you know, hot streak, and hope to, by the end of the month, be at least in striking distance, and if not, give everyone that, you know, experience of what it was like to play for something other than your own numbers or possibility of being on the team next year. So, you know, there's a big picture, and then there's the reality of guys who, you know, kind of really stepped up all year long and wanting to see this fight carried to the end. But, you know, there's a realization, but this team has been very good. Mike Redmond set that tone about turning the page, and no matter how tough something looked, to, you know, is forge forward, and that's kind of where they are right now.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of set me up for this. It's regardless of how this turns out, you know, something we talked about probably a month ago was that they wanted guys to feel like they were playing in a race, and they got more than that. These guys actually played in a race. What do you think, and what does the organization think, is the value going forward of having even gotten, however this turns out, and again, not to bury them, they could well get back in this, but however it turns out, to have gotten legitimate contention at the end of August? What is the belief around the organization of value there?
When Michael Hill and Dan Jennings stepped into their roles, you know, after last year as, you know, president of baseball ops and GM, they made an effort to go out and get players with playoff experience, and that's when they brought in Saul Palamacchia and Garrett Jones and, you know, Furcal, who obviously was hurt all year. They didn't get much out of him, but they were targeting guys who had been through it, and that was a mindset, meaningful games. They talked playoffs in spring training on a team that, you know, just came off 100 losses. And, you know, so this is more feeding into the same. And, you know, when right now, the double A Jacksonville team is in the playoffs, and catcher JP Realmuto will be up here and would have been up here on September 1, but the Suns qualified for the playoffs, so he's in the playoffs now. When that's over, he'll come in, experience September baseball in the big league. So, and one reason they're not going to pluck him off the Jacksonville team is they want him to experience what it's like to you know, go through it. And as Mike Redmond, who was part of the playoff teams in Minnesota and part of the Marlins 03 World Series team, he knows you can't talk about it. You have to actually experience it. You know, there's only so much you could tell somebody. So every game they play, you know, and they're going to have Atlanta and Washington, a lot of games against them, out in Anaheim, you know, playing fairly well, taking one out of three there. But, you know, experiencing that, playing the team with the best record in the game and going toe-to-toe with them, all this is part of development. You know, that's, you know, they consider winning and competing part of development, seeing how guys respond to that. So, you know, that all ties in and all folds under one umbrella, but it also is consistent with the theme. They probably couldn't have drawn it up much better outside of, you know, save the injuries of what this year's kind of turned out to be. So the fact that meaningful games is even being mentioned in Miami is a win for them.
The position that Mike Redmond was put in last year and this year is often a tough position, and a lot of times it seems like when a club is rebuilding, you almost feel like the guy hired to manage that team is hired to be fired. A lot of times it seems like that guy's there to get him through a couple years, and then you bring in the manager who's going to be there when you start winning. I think it's safe to say that's not the case with Redmond. What have you seen in his development as a manager, both tactically and also in the clubhouse, to establish him as a guy who, for my money, is really having one of the better years of any manager in either league?
Yeah, he really is, and he's kind of an extension of the team. I mean, he is what they are. I mean, he's going through his growing pains, but they're all kind of in it together. You know, it is interesting. You know, he's got his players back. He's incredibly upbeat. He's a very good communicator, a strong relationship with the front office, you know, strong relationship with his players. And, you know, there's always that cliche, a team takes on the personality of its you know, leader, manager, coach. They're kind of doing that, you know, across the board, down to their respective position coaches. You know, the hitters, Frankie Menichino is doing a very good job as the hitting coach, and he's a no-nonsense, you know, take no slack, give them no slack, just pressure them to excel, knowing full well that they're not always going to come through, but, you know, always urging that. And the hitters, even though the results aren't always there, their mindset is that. And Red, the same thing, you know, be patient, yet encouraging, yet upbeat, yet accountable. You know, all those things have been preached to them, and it's very consistent. And I've never seen a team, Matthew, that, you know, could go off, they could lose five in a row, and the sixth day, they're like, we're going to beat these guys. We're better. We're fine.
Have you also seen him develop tactically? Because it seems like that's often one of the things we've seen in recent years is you hire a guy who can lead and figure out he'll learn how to run a game as the years go by.
Yeah, and that's where I think the criticisms you'll see of Red would be strategical or tactical, where you're like, why did he leave him in that long? Or why didn't he make the move there? Because it's almost looking like he's letting, you know, this guy throw a seventh inning, an eighth inning, a guy who's never done that before, trying to get the Cardinals out or something like that, when it's like, go to your bullpen right there, manage. I think you go through, and you've seen it, you've covered it, you manage differently when the season's on the line. You know, you're not saying, oh, well, let's see if this guy could go seven today just for his own good, or let's give this guy a bat against a tough lefty to see how he does. You know, you have to make that decision that the urgency is right here, right now, and I'm going to lose making moves trying to get matchups. And I think Red's transitioning there too. And, you know, that's all part of it. And like I said, he's a guy who I think is growing on the job as well. You know, he gets really high grades in terms of getting guys to play for him, in terms of communication, in terms of, you know, putting these guys in position to win or succeed, really high grades to him in that regard.
The Marlins made a couple call-ups, but to me, to most people, seems like by far the most noteworthy one is Andrew Haney. This was a guy who was really hyped, had a really good first start, kind of had some struggles, and at least based on the numbers, didn't really have a great time after he was sent back down. Where is he at right now in his development? Do you think he's a guy who is part of this rotation next year? Is this a good year overall for him? Or I mean, it just seems like an interesting year for a guy who, again, had huge hype.
Yeah, I mean, it started kind of in the Arizona Fall League. He dominated there, came into spring training, was very good, but knew all along he was going to start off in Double A. You know, the rotation at that time obviously had Jose, and you know, so let the kid go down, number one rated lefty by MLB.com in all of baseball, Marlins number one prospect. Let him go do his thing at Jacksonville. And, man, he came out of the chute doing that. Was very good with Jacksonville, earned his promotion. Organizationally, the team changed philosophies from years past, bringing up Josh Johnson, Dontrell Willis, and everybody else from Double A straight to the big leagues. They said, no, we're not even going to rush him. We're going to not that June 5th or whatever service time deadline. We're going to push him to give him five or six starts at AAA and see a different breed of hitting, be a little bit more challenging there, guys with big league experience. He goes there, does very well, earns his call-up. And like you said, he started off against the Mets. He had a quality outing, didn't get the win, but it spiraled away from him quickly after that. And then he went back down after a really rough start in St. Louis in early July and had kind of an up-and-down second half with the Zephyrs in AAA. And now I'm mildly surprised, Matthew, that he's here, because I thought they might say, you know what, you know, let's get him physically bigger because he has room in his body to grow. He's thrown about 150 innings. Let's send him down. But when Henderson Alvarez had his little oblique issue and his status is unclear, you know, they're hoping it's not serious and he could be back soon, then Heaney is now up in the big leagues and may get a start or two. I would think his season would probably be over by about September 18th or so, assuming he gets a start or two up here now. But this could be a big month for him. You know, they still believe in him. They still have high hopes. He's just 23. And the stuff was really good in the first half, and then the stuff just seemed to flatten. And I don't know whether he tried to do too much, if he got caught up in the moment. But, you know, he definitely, they needed to pull the brakes on, you know, put the brakes on and pull back and just say, hey, look, you know, collect yourself, figure out, you know, learn and grow. But, and you know, answer your question, see in rotation next year, clearly have to earn it, you know, and that will be a spring training thing. And if he does earn it, I'm not looking at him in the 1, 2, 3 spots. I'm looking at he's earning the fifth starter spot. So, still some stuff to show in these last few weeks in this season, but, overall, I think you got to say it was humbling for him and an eye opener, and we will see if he makes the adjustments to be what they think he can be.
All right. Well, Joe Fusaro, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras, talking New York Mets with MLB.com's Mets beat reporter Anthony DiComo. It's been a little bit of a disappointing year, I think, for the Mets, but it's been one that's had some real bright spots and some things to get excited about going forward. And it seems like there's another one here within the last few days. Tell me about the newest young swinging Met, Mr. Herrera.
Yeah, Gilson Herrera he's an interesting little player. You know, the sort of the scouting book on him is he's probably about average to above average glove, which we haven't really seen yet. He had a little trouble with that when he first came up, but he's an average to above average glove with a lot of pop for someone who's 5'8". I think he profiles as a guy who could, you know, hit 10 to 15 homers in the majors with a decent batting average, which is a nice thing to have from a middle infield position. He's played a little shortstop, but he's really a second baseman, and they're going to try him out there pretty much exclusively in September. You know, Daniel Murphy going to the disabled list was a little bit of a blessing in disguise, or silver lining for the Mets, in that they can take a look at Herrera now. At age 20, he's the youngest player in the big leagues, and you know, they're not sure exactly what they have, but he's definitely shown some bright spots already at the plate, and you know, they like him. They like him as a good little player.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because I've certainly been wrong more than a few times, not just in the past, but today even. But it seemed like at the time the deal was made when they acquired him, the reaction was, oh, nice get, but not, you know, not necessarily a guy who had the potential to be a big league regular in the relatively near future. Is this a guy whose stock has climbed since the deal, or was he maybe undersold even at the time of the deal?
Yeah, I mean, he definitely moved fast. And if you look at what they got in that trade for essentially for a month of Marlon Byrd when they were already well out of the race, to get a guy who now profiles maybe as a big league regular in a middle infield position, and a really hard-throwing reliever who's already had some success. I mean, that's pretty good. I think at the time, you know, he was a little overshadowed because they did get Vic Black in that deal, and Vic Black was already very close to the majors, and he came up in September and you know, really showed his stuff right away. So people were kind of focused on Vic, And this is a guy who is 19 at the time. You're saying, oh, well, you know, we'll look up one day and, you know, maybe he'll be a prospect for us. And, you know, he didn't really light those prospect lists on fire. I think he's the number 8 Mets prospect as far as MLB.com ranks them. So he's not exactly that blue chipper, you know, like when Travis d'Arnaud came up last year or anything like that. But I don't think anyone's overlooking him anymore. I mean, I think this is a guy who, you know, maybe he's not going to be on the team next April 1st, but I don't think anyone would be surprised at this point if he comes up and makes an impact at some point next summer and really going forward establishes himself in that middle infield conversation.
It has the makings of being kind of an interesting roster crunch. I mean, third base is pretty well set, and it looks like maybe first base is squared away too. Mets have a pretty good second baseman, though he's a guy who's been talked about as a potential candidate for a move. And then you've got Herrera, and you've got Wilmer Flores, who's playing some shortstop. And you know, Ruben Tejada hasn't had a terrible year. I know he's not the most popular guy, but he's had a pretty decent year. How do they make all these pieces fit together with only 4 infield spots and no DH in the National League?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about all the pieces you just mentioned are that all of them have some sort of potential. All of them have something that they do well, but none of them, you know, have been good enough that they've really laid claim to the position. I mean, Wilmer Flores, you know, has been a top prospect in this organization forever, and he's had multiple chances this summer to really wrest that starting shortstop job away from Ruben Tejada, and he hasn't been able to do it. You know, now in September, they're playing him every day, and he's really just now starting to hit well. You know, if he goes and has a monster September or even a very good September, he could sort of put himself in a position where he's, you know, looked at as the starting shortstop when it's his job to lose going forward, which is something that Ruben Tejada has had the past couple of years and, you know, has been off and on, but more off than on, I would say. So, you know, they've definitely got some interesting pieces. And what Herrera adds to the mix is if he comes on and has a great September, you know, it's not necessarily means Daniel Murphy's a goner this winter. I think that's something they were going to look at doing anyways, is trading Murphy, considering where his contract is going to be a year out from free agency and all that. But it gives them a little more flexibility where they don't necessarily have to fear that. You know, they can say, well, maybe Herrera's not ready right now, but we have the pieces between Tejada and Flores to hold us over. You know, it's not necessarily the end of the world if we trade Daniel Murphy. I'm not saying they're going to do that, but it's certainly something they're going to have to look at, and it might be something at this point that's in the best interest of the franchise, given that roster crunch you talked about.
Yeah, Flores is an interesting guy because when they started talking about him at shortstop, I wasn't there in the scrum, but I got to imagine there were some baffled looks and maybe even some snickers. I mean, this is a guy who's known for his bat and not really known for his glove, even away from shortstop, and yet it seems like he's been at least adequate enough to hold his own at short for that to continue to be a possibility, and yet he hasn't really hit. First and foremost, why do you think he hasn't taken off more at the plate for a guy who came as such a lauded hitter through the minors?
Yeah, it's a good question, and he's basically proven everything there is to prove at AAA. I mean, he's gone down there and raked, and you can talk all you want about the Pacific Coast League and especially Vegas being a hitter's park and a hitter's league, but he's gone well above and beyond, and there's really no point in him being down there anymore. You know, why that hasn't translated to the majors, I don't know. I mean, some guys, that's just a big leap. You know, in his case, if you're looking for excuses, you could say, well, he's come up and he's played a game, and then he's sat 2, and then he's played 2, and then he's sat 3. And it's really hard to get established, especially when it's one of your first couple tastes of the level. And maybe that's it. I mean, he's playing every day now. He's really playing better than he has at any point since he's been up there. You know, last year he came up in September, had a little cup of coffee, and wasn't completely healthy. He had some leg issues going on that he was playing through, so it wasn't the best barometer of what he's capable of doing. But, yeah, I mean, even now when he's hitting, he's not really showing that extra base pop, and until that comes, you're really not going to commit to a guy. But he does show the tools. He shows flashes, and you look up every once in a while, you see him hit a ball right on the nose, and you say, oh, this is the guy they've been talking about for the past 6 or 7 years. You know, we forget how young he is. He's still in his very early 20s, and he still has that potential. I think given playing time, and I think he's going to get it here going down the stretch and maybe into next season, he will have every opportunity to show it.
Has he been adequate enough at shortstop that if he hits, that all adds up to worth doing?
Yeah, I think he's been surprisingly good defensively. I mean, there are plays. I mean, he's had a couple games. Just there was a game in L.A. where he, you know, booted a ball and fell down. It was almost comical. And he's had a couple flashes like that where you look up and you say, okay, this guy, you know, really, I see what they're talking about now. He's not a shortstop. But, you know, far away, those have been few and far between. I mean, he's made the routine plays. He's not exactly the smoothest guy in the world around the bag turning double plays, but he's getting it done. You know, the arm strength he could stand to improve, you know, the footwork he could stand to improve. But at the end of the day, he's making the plays more often than not. And it's not like Ruben Tejada was this amazing defensive shortstop. He was good, you know, at his best. He was definitely above average. But he also had some lapses of his own over there. I'm not saying Ruben Tejada is, you know, worse than Wilmer Flores. I don't think anyone would argue that. But if Wilmer can certainly go above and beyond that offensive threshold that Tejada has established the past couple of years, I think from what we've seen, you have to think his gloves can play. If you're going to go offensive that position, he's definitely meeting, at least right now, that minimum defensive threshold that you need to meet.
And it seems like, and I'm not entirely sure why this is, but it seems like the other guy that's kind of been talked about around the Mets here again lately is Juan Lagares. And he, you know, there's been some talk about, can anybody be as good as the metrics say he is defensively? He's kind of had some pluses and some minuses with the bat. As he gets to the end of this year, what do you think the kind of overall story of Lagares' story of season is this year?
Yeah, I mean, he came into this year almost fighting for playing time, and it was sort of the opposite of what we were just talking about with Wilmer Flores. It was a guy who you knew he was already Gold Glove caliber defensively, and it was just a matter of if he could hit. I mean, Gold Glove's great and all, but if you're going to hit 200 with a 650 OPS, that's not going to fly. Now, the thing about Lagares offensively is he has the tools. I mean, it's obvious to people that he can hit. He really has a nose for squaring up the ball, and you know when he's hot, he does those things with regularity. His main problem is he's a bad ball hitter. He's always has been a bad ball hitter, and he falls in love with chasing that ball out of the zone, and he can't hold up, and that leads to strikeouts and you know, no walks, and he doesn't have that on-base percentage. So it's been an issue. Now, the stretches he's had, and you can really see, and you can look at the numbers, the stretches he's had where he's been hot at the plate, and, you know, he's not a home run hitter, but he can drive the ball in the gap for sure and give you some singles and doubles. But those stretches have always coincided with the plate discipline. So, you know, if he can figure out a way, or the Mets can sort of pound it into his head that, you know, just wait for your pitch in the zone, which is sort of their team-wide philosophy, but, you know, he's a little bit of a square peg in a round hole in that sense. You know, but if he can catch on, I think he's not going to be an offensive star, but if he could be offensively adequate, and given his defense, that's more than enough.
Do you think it's realistic? They're talking about him as a leadoff man. Do you think it's realistic that he can get enough control of the strike zone to be a passable leadoff man? I mean, putting aside stolen bases, you got to get on base for the guys who drive and runs. Do you think he has the capacity to at least do enough that he gets on base enough to be a reasonable leadoff man?
Yeah, I at this point in his career, I find it a little hard to believe, only because he really hasn't shown it for any extended length of time. Now, like you said, he's prone to streakiness a little bit, and when he gets on one of these hot streaks where, you know, he is controlling the strike zone and you know, maybe drawing a couple more walks and just getting on base with his hits, then, yeah, you could probably stick him there. You could definitely stick him there in a pinch, and guys can obviously get better. But as far as the, you know, base skill set that he has, I'm not sure if he's that guy. He hasn't really shown it thus far, but the Mets also don't have that guy. So he might become it by default. And if he does, you could probably do worse considering what he's given them, especially lately.
All right. Well, Anthony Nocomo, thanks for chatting here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Philadelphia Phillies with MLB.com's Phillies beat reporter, Todd Zalecki. Todd, it seems like we have some version of this conversation nearly every week, but you wrote an item this week that general manager Ruben Amaro said moves are coming this winter, and that things have to change. But there weren't a lot of specifics, which I guess is understandable. You may not know, and if you do know, you're not going to tip your hand. But read between the lines first a little, if you will. What do you think he meant with that sort of changes coming statement?
Well, I think it's an acknowledgement of sorts that they know they must make changes to get better. In other words, I think they went into this season, and based off the contract that they gave A.J. Burnett in February, they really believed that with everybody healthy, they were going to be able to compete. Now, they pretty much had everybody healthy all year, excluding Cliff Lee, and you know they're in last place in the National League East. So I think they've finally come to that realization that, you know what, we're not going to be able just to sign a free agent starting pitcher in the offseason, maybe find a bat in left field or something, and be a 90-win team again. So I think it's his acknowledgement that they're going to have to make some type of moves to kind of start getting them back on the right track. And now how if they can accomplish that is a totally different question, but at least I think they're going to try as hard as they can to get things changed around. That includes trading somebody like Papelbon, somebody like Ryan Howard, finding a couple new outfielders, you know, things along that nature. And those things are not easily done.
If that is in fact the case, and if it is a full-on, even if sort of vaguely so, if it is in fact a full acknowledgement that the direction needs to change, that seems pretty big to me, because it seems like for a long time the position of this club has been almost defiant, that we're good enough to win, and it's close, and the pieces are here. And if I'm reading correctly, and if I'm hearing you correctly, that seems to me like a fairly significant change. Do you think that's an accurate read?
I do, yes, I do. And, you know, you wonder how they're going to kind of go about their business in the offseason, if they might take a longer view look at things rather than a shorter view look at things, in terms of, you know, let's just try to plug a hole here, let's try to get this guy, have him play left field, let's try to get this guy to fill out the rotation, and then hope if everybody's healthy again that, you know, this team can produce. And so I think they might maybe take a little bit of a step back and not go out there and just go crazy, spend money. Not to say that they won't go after, you know, there's a Cuban free agent outfielder out there, Yasmani Tomas. I think they might try to make a run at him. That would be a big-time move. But, you know, I don't think they're going to I think they understand where they are, and I think they understand that they have a lot of things they need to improve upon to get better. You know, it's even if they would sign Yasmani Tomas or, you know, make a trade to help improve the offense, they are still so far away from competing. And I think that's at least an important acknowledgement. You know, like I said, they went out and they signed A.J. Burnett to a one-year $16 million deal with a really expensive player option, because they said, you know what, we still think we can win. And so this acknowledgement is, in my opinion, a pretty big change of course, or, you know, different way of looking at things.
I'm almost hesitant to bring it up because I don't want to make it on the level of baseball decisions, but I feel like it's something we need to talk about. David Montgomery is clearly an absolutely enormous figure in that organization, and at least for the time being, he's not going to be around running the organization. There's obviously a personal impact there, and he's a guy, as you've written repeatedly, is just really highly regarded.
Right.
From just an organizational perspective, what is the impact of this organization running on a day-to-day basis in the absence of a guy who really has, in a lot of ways, been the kind of figurehead for the organization for quite a long time?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see kind of how it all shakes out. But my understanding is that, you know, Pat Gillick is assuming David's responsibilities, and, you know, I'm sure he's going to have he's going to lean heavily on a lot of his vice presidents, you know, in terms of operations, administration, sales, marketing, you know, those types of things. But I think he is definitely going to be have a greater hand in terms of baseball operations. And, you know, he served as a senior advisor for David Montgomery and for Ruben Amaro Jr. since 2008, when he retired as GM. But he was an advisor. So, you know, he would tell Ruben, you know, I like this move. I like what you're thinking here, or I don't like this move, and I don't like what you're thinking here. He'd do the same thing with David. But ultimately, when it came down to it, you know, it was David's decision and Ruben's decision. And now with Pat kind of assuming those roles, you know, he'll be able to wield greater influence. So I think it's going to have a, you know, a pretty significant impact on how the organization goes about things. And not to say that he's going to make a lot of big changes, because that's not Pat Gillick's style. When he replaced Ed Wade in 2005, everybody said, all right, he's going to come in here and clean house. He didn't make any changes at all. But the guy is such a baseball genius that, you know, he put all the people in the right places and made it work. And so, again, he worked with those two guys before, but now that he's kind of assumed the role as interim president, I think he'll be even more involved. And again, he can give the yay or the nay to certain moves if he feels strongly about it either way.
And on the personal level, I mean, it has been striking. There's been so much written. Can you just give people an idea of the kind of personal regard that David Montgomery has held in within that organization, this organization that he's been such a key part of for so long?
Yeah, you know, you see a lot of players when they leave the Phillies via free agency. I'll talk to them, you know, when they come back into town, say, how are things going? And, you know, this might be the next season, or it might be a couple of years down the road or whatever. And they say, I tell you what, Phillies really know how to treat people. Like, you know, wives, kids, themselves personally, they do a lot of really nice things for people. And that really does start with Dave Montgomery. You know, David is a guy, you know, team president of a multi-million-dollar operation. If you're a sales intern, he will get to know your name. He will get to know where you're from. He's that type of guy. I mean, he really makes a point to know people. He's come up to me all the time and like, hey, how's it going with this? How's it going with that? You know, media members, like I said, interns, low-level employees. He really takes it upon himself to know who everybody is. And you know, think about like big corporations. You know, a president who would know the marketing intern and not just recognize the face, but know their first and last name, and then see them walking down the hallway and say, hey, Joe, how's it going today? You know, that type of thing. And that really kind of permeates throughout the organization. A lot of people describe it as they call it the Phillies family. It really is a family type of atmosphere. And for a major multi-million-dollar company, it does have a kind of mom-and-pop quality or feel to it, and it all, without a doubt, it goes back to Dave Montgomery. He really kind of stresses that point and tries to create that feel, and that's why I think a lot of employees were really, you know, broken up about the fact that he's taking a medical leave of absence, and I know it's been trying on a lot of people in the organization. Like, they really do care about this guy a lot, and it's not just kind of lip service. Like, they really duly, truly care about this guy, and it's been tough on people.
And one more thing while we've got you here. There have been a lot of really great players in this organization, and you wrote in your story about Cole Hamels' no-hitter, which obviously is the other biggest news this week, that he set really big goals from the start, and he's checked off most of them. With this latest kind of check-off, to go along with the no-hitter, to go along with the World Series, to go along with all the other things he's accomplished. For a relatively young guy, where does Hamels rank right now in the kind of history of the Phillies organization? I got to think he's climbing that ladder pretty rapidly.
Yeah, he is. You know, today's day and age, it's tougher to get wins. He hasn't been a 20-game winner, but when you look at the numbers he's put up and how successful he has been over the years, I mean, when all is said and done, even if he stopped pitching this year for the Phillies, if they would trade him in the offseason, for example, I think he'll be regarded as one of the top starting pitchers for sure. And you know, it's a list that includes Robin Roberts, Steve Carlton, Grover Cleveland-Alexander, Curt Schilling, Jim Bunning. And honestly, I think Cole Hamels, those are five great guys. Roy Halladay, he's right underneath those five or six pitchers in terms of impacting the organization, and probably more so than Roy, because he's pitched with the Phillies longer, and he was a NLCS and a World Series MVP in 2008. But, you know, when you're talking about Bunning, Schilling, Alexander, Steve Carlton, Cole Hamels, I think it says a lot, because the Phillies have been around for a long time, and when Cole leaves, you know, he's not going to have to buy a meal or a drink in Philadelphia as long as he comes back into town, long after his playing career is over.
Which obviously explains a big part of why they felt the need not only to lock him up long-term, but to keep him around. Todd Zielecki, thanks for dropping in here on MLB.com Extras.
Thanks for listening to MLB.com Extras.